The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Right, he saw Eloy, he's all excited, wants to be a lawyer, right? Or, I can't do the music for this one, or he saw ER, he's all excited about being a doctor. And he says, you know, I'm doing pre-med, and then I'm going to medical school, and I know it's a long haul, but I'm very excited about it. And he happens to visit, I don't know, my father is a radiologist, so he happens to visit my in-law's house, walks down into their basement, and he sees an entire wall covered with books. And fear and horror overtake him. Or the lawyer walks into, I don't know about you guys, if you've ever been in a lawyer's office, I'm not convinced that they ever open these books. But they've got that big set of like the law books. This is it. You know, 500 volumes of law. And I always think that law school is just to teach you how to find what's in there. Like, I can't imagine that anybody knows what's in all those books. Maybe if they know where to look for it. But the truth is that many people feel that way when it comes to Judaism. You know... Pardon? Yeah! Now that's it. Now you see, that didn't hit me until a student mentioned that to me. Because I got the same thing in my house. Because anybody who's in Jewish education just has that, just like any doctor has that. And I remember I was once sitting with a student, and this is just as an aside, the appreciation of the gradual approach of doing things gradually. I was sitting with a student, and he was just like, wow. He came to visit me in my house. We were sitting having a long talk about a serious issue, and he was waiting for me. I was finishing a phone call, and so he was in my study, and he was like, wow, look at all these books, whatever, and I have books in the living room, and whatever. And I have more books that aren't even unpacked yet from when we moved. And then at one point he says, you know, what's this book? And I was talking about that book. And he asked me about another book. And he says, have you read these books? So I said, well, yeah, why would I have them in my house otherwise? You buy a book, you read it. That's why they're there, you know. Can I tell you I remember what's in them? No, you know, that's a problem. And in his eyes, I had this incredible opportunity to appreciate this process. So now here you are. And let's assume for the moment that there's something going on. That a person develops a desire to pursue this. You know, the beginning of this program was, I'm going to show you what I think is a beautiful system. What you do with that beautiful system is up to you. But I think it's a beautiful system, so I want to share it with you. Wonderful. Now let's say I did that. And let's say for some of you, you decide, well, this is a system I want to pursue further. So how do you do that? So, notwithstanding some of the things I spoke about yesterday, having a teacher, having partnerships, tools of study, where do I go to in the library and how do I get started? So we've taken a look at a couple of books. This book, right? Just in terms of how to. The Siddur, the prayer book, in terms of the structure. And now I wanted to talk to you, well, this is somewhat of a deceptive thing. Because this is not a book, but a type of book. And there are different authors who wrote different books that fit into this category of a type of book. What do you think is the basic building block of this thing that we call Judaism, this system? Hey, what's the basic building block? The basic unit in as much of a broken down form as I can find it, whose forms the backbone. Pardon? Well, the Torah is the system. But now, you know, I come to this book, I don't even know where to start. In fact, I told you when we were looking at this book, at the Torah, that I wouldn't start from the beginning of creation necessarily because that's an overwhelming story. You pick a story. So what is the basic unit? I mean, I wake up tomorrow morning and I say, okay, you know, Nike, just do it. I want to do it. But I don't know what to do. So I want to start doing it. Well, what is it? So maybe you know, walk out of one person's class and you just sort of walk over the window and say, I'm going to start doing it. And you close your eyes and you begin to meditate. That's tremendous. Maybe you walk out of another person's class and you go out into the street and you find someone who disagrees and you start to argue. You know, argue, struggle with it. Maybe you walk out of another person's class and you say, okay, I'm just going to start smiling at everybody. That's how I do it. Everybody does it their way. But you walk away saying, no, but I'm not yet doing it. I want to be identified as a Jew. I want to be doing Jewish things. So we have these images of what Jewish things are. And those images are not wrong. Despite the fact that I've spent a week breaking down those images and telling you that, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean you're religious just because you don't pick up the phone on Shabbat. And it doesn't mean you're irreligious because you do. Notwithstanding that truth, that doesn't mean that these images that we have of what are the basic building blocks of Judaism are incorrect. Shabbat, keeping kosher, whatever I want to call them, prayer, right? So what do I call those things?
Laws.
Mitzvot, right? Those are the broken down unit. Now, how many mitzvot are there? 613. I don't know about you, but when I started to first think about that number, I became tremendously depressed. Because I said, I'm going to start studying these mitzvot. That would seem to be a basic thing to do. You know, we spoke about the fact that you don't just start with Torah and then finish Torah and then move on to prophets and finish prophets and move on to Psalms and finish that and start to study ethics. But you're sort of involved in different projects, multi-leveled at the same time, right? So if you look at it, it's a good thing to do. I'll take one mitzvah every day. And I'll work on it. And so, of course, I opened up the first, you know, and discovered that one of the mitzvot is there's a mitzvah to believe in God. So how do you ever get to number two? I mean, where do you go from there? So that's a topic in and of itself, which actually we discussed last program. So, but if you're curious about how that works, you can definitely come over and talk to me about it. But pick any mitzvah. The mitzvah of Ve'ahavta L'Re'echa Kamocha. Love thy neighbor as thyself. Do you know what that is? Do you know what it is to love your fellow human being like you love yourself? You know, we love ourselves. We do. If we don't, that's a different issue. But, you know, it's good to love yourself. It's good to wake up in the morning and, you know, just go, ah, you know, I love myself, right? And so that's a boundless, how do I do that with someone else? How can I love you as much as I love me? Where do I begin? It's a great platitude, you know? It's good, and it's very important, because this way rabbis have something to say. You know, you can stand up on the podium and say, love thy neighbor as thyself, and that's great, but what does that mean? How do I do that? I remember once, you know, there are very few teaching challenges that came close to one particular teaching challenge that I have. I used to skateboard a lot. I loved skateboarding. And even when I was in Pittsburgh teaching, there was one particular night where I went to a class at Pitt. That was kind of like my airtime, Pittsburgh University. And I went from a teaching a group that I was teaching, and I would take my skateboard and I would skate down through this golf course. It's tremendous. And, you know, I didn't have time to get on a t-shirt or whatever, so I had like a tie on, whatever. And every now and then I'd run into a student, just watch their mouths. And it was tremendous. So I had one student who I was really trying to develop a relationship with. He actually came from a very difficult background. He's actually here in Israel now. That's a whole story. But anyway, and this was kind of the glue. This was kind of the thing that we found, that I found, that he could relate to. So he wanted me to teach him how to skateboard. Give me a kid. Tell him to teach him Bible. Hey, great. Let's go flying. You know, skateboarding? How do you teach a kid to skateboard? Like, when you learn, you make mistakes. Right? This is not a good thing when you're teaching a 15-year-old on a skateboard going down a hill. So I couldn't come up with a system to teach him a skateboard. So now, I want to study mitzvot. Where do I start? How do you do that? How do I begin? So the rabbis understood that this was a problem, because if I study one mitzvah every day, it's going to take me 2 years just to get through the mitzvot. And by the way, you could spend weeks and weeks and weeks on a given mitzvah and still not feel that you were even close. So there's a type of book. Now the one who was the most famous author of such a book was Maimonides, but in fact he wasn't the first to do it. And different authors had different systems for listing these things that we call mitzvot. And they use different systems of divisions. And what I want to show you is a couple of different books that go through these mitzvot that allow us, if we should so choose, to begin to develop a relationship with a given mitzvah, that make the intangible a little more concrete and that allow me to divide up my time so that it's a realistic goal to at least become familiar. In other words, I don't know whether it would be fair for one human being to say that another human being should do X. Because for me to say that I think that Jews, all Jews, should celebrate Shabbat, well, that's a bit of a pompous, judgmental thing to say. So, you know, you already know me, that's not me. To say that, you know, it might be that if a Jew celebrates Shabbat, they might find it beautiful, okay, maybe that's legitimate to say. But to say that it would cause me pain, that there are Jews who don't even know what Shabbat is, that I feel justified in saying. I'm not saying that it's for me to say whether what they should do with it. So, that you could go through a list and become aware of what these building blocks, what these mitzvot are, that's a magnificent thing. And that's why I think this is a very important topic. Because this is one of those major types of Jewish books that is literally a door-opening experience. And before we go on, and I'm going to give you a few pieces of paper, before we go on, we have to do one thing. What is a mitzvah? What is a mitzvah? How would I define, right? Is there anybody here, by the way, who has never heard this term before? For whom this word is just, you know, new? So you've heard the term mitzvah, is that fair? Right? A mitzvah, do a mitzvah, right? Okay. What does mitzvah mean?
God's commandment.
Pardon?
God's commandment.
God's commandment. Okay. That's not what the actual term means. But let's say that, so what does mitzvah mean? You say commandment. Mitzvat Hashem, the mitzvah of Hashem, would be God's commandment. So mitzvah means commandment. Interesting. Mitzvah, in linguistically, is actually a passive word. It literally is, right, the commanded act. That which is commanded. Which is a little different from a commandment. Pardon? Well, you know what? I actually used to think that that was so. A deed seems to be a ma'aseh, an action. A mitzvah seems to be an imperative. For example, if you study, when I was doing my teacher's degree, so one of the most frightening things that I had to do was take a year's worth of Hebrew language, like advanced Hebrew language courses. The theory being, if I'm going to have a teacher's degree and teach in Israel, I have to be able to stand in front of a class without making mistakes in the language of the country where I'm teaching, which makes me sense. So at the end of this year, you have to stand before a panel of three individuals from the Ministry of Education and whatever else, right? And they give you an exam. Part of it is like a two-hour oral exam. And if you don't pass this exam, then you can't get your teacher's degree, and you can only take this exam once a year. You have to wait a whole year to take it again, right? So you can imagine that, you know, it's a little nerve-wracking to take this type of exam. And I remember specifically that the thought hit me, what I'm about to say, in the middle of this exam, right? Because one of the binyanim, one of the structural forms of the Hebrew language, you know, you have, for example, avar, hove, and atid, past, present, and future. Like I would say, ani halachti, I went, ani holech, I'm going right now, ani elech, right? I will go. Those are the three basic forms. Then you have more, maybe, advanced or lesser known forms, for example, hulachti, which means that I was walked, right? Holich, he was walking someone else. And there are different forms. And one of the forms is what's called binyan tzivui, the imperative. When I come to someone and I say, lech, go, right? That's the imperative, right? Daber, speak. So what does that mean? What does that mean that there's an imperative? It implies that there's a command. Tzivui is a command. Now, mitzvah is that action which is commanded. And that's a very important distinction, and I'll tell you why. And now I'm just sharing with you my perspective. We tend to view actions in a vacuum. In other words, if there's a car, and the car is moving, and there's someone sitting behind the wheel, then the action is driving a car. And that's all it is. It's driving a car. The truth is that that action has many implications to it. Why is the person driving the car? Where is the person driving the car? What does driving the car mean to that person? What potential exists within that action of driving a car? And the reason that we call an action, a deed, a mitzvah, is because an action in Judaism has to be viewed, so it would seem, as an imperative. In other words, I'm not looking at this action in a vacuum. I'm looking at an action, and I'm trying to relate it to me. What does it mean to me? What purpose is there in that action? You know, I mentioned to you when we were first looking at Torah study, I said that if you look at the beginning of Genesis, one of the opening lines of the entire story of creation is Vayomer Elohim Yehi Or, and God said, let there be light. And I said that science's perspective, I think we talked about this, right, focuses on the let there be light. What does that mean? How was there light? What was that light? Where did that light come from? How was the world created? Jewish tradition, Torah, seems to be much more interested in the Vayomer Elohim. If I see the creation of the light, but I don't hear God saying, let there be light, I've missed the action. Not just that I'm seeing the action, but I'm missing something else. I'm actually missing the action. Because the act of light coming into the world as an action doesn't have implication for me. It doesn't give me meaning to my life. If I can hear the purpose in the action, then it affects who I am. Why do I tell you all this? Because I don't think it's accidental that the Torah divides itself up in its most basic format into a list of actions, of activities. One could argue that action, activity, really is ensconced in the physical world. The challenge, perhaps, is to view what lies behind the given action, the implication of the action, the purpose of the action, the meaning of the action, and most of all, the source of the action. Talmud says, the word mitzvah, we'll call it commandment, implies mitzaveh, a commander. You can't have a commandment without a commander. As a matter of fact, that's one of the most basic premises in the army. Everything that exists in the army, you get trained from the first day of basic training to ask yourself one simple question. Who bears responsibility for this action? Where does this come from? In fact, you have to almost untrain your general system of thought to begin to think that way. You know, part of it is perhaps a Jewish reaction to the terrible events of 50 years ago. There is no such thing in the Israeli army as following orders. There was a famous incident in the 50s of a village where there was a curfew for various reasons. They were throwing Molotov cocktails, whatever it was. And there was a curfew, and the division commander passed the command on to the battalion commander that there should be a curfew, and that no one should be allowed out of their houses after 5 o'clock, right? Or they'd be severely punished. So the battalion commander gave orders to his men that if they saw anyone outside of their homes after 5 o'clock, they had the right to undertake what's called Noel Pticha Be'esh. There's a system of commands which you have to follow in order to make a decision to open fire. If I see someone in the middle of the night and that someone is suspicious, I can't just start firing. I have to first call out, who are you? I have to call out, stop. If the person doesn't stop, I have to fire in the air. If the firing in the air doesn't stop, I have to fire at his legs. Only after I've done this procedure, whatever it is, can I then fire in order to kill. Unless someone's firing at me, right? So, this battalion commander gave the order that in fact they could legitimately undertake such a series of commands which could eventually lead to firing at another human being as soon as somebody was out of their home after 5 o'clock. So one afternoon, a group was on patrol, and they saw a couple of people from a distance, and they called out to them, where are you? Because it was already 6 o'clock, right? It was well after the curfew time. And these people started to run. And so based on these commands that had been handed down from the battalion commander to the company commander to the officer who was on the scene, right, they eventually fired in the air, fired in the legs, and eventually they fired at these two individuals, killing one and wounding another. Now it turned out that this was a father and his son, who had been just sort of delayed at the end of their work day for whatever the reasons, and they were getting home late. And when they saw the soldiers, they got scared. They didn't understand the Hebrew, possibly. And they started to run. So now it gets very interesting. The division commander was reprimanded for this incident, for not giving clear commands. The battalion commander was removed from his post and given a one-year, like a deferral. In other words, a suspension, right? In other words, you can't, no mobility in rank and everything else. The lieutenant who was on the scene who gave the orders, the okay, was put in jail, as were the men who followed the orders. That doesn't make sense. Who's responsible? If the lieutenant is responsible, then the men were following orders. And if the men were responsible, then it wasn't the lieutenant's fault. Except that this is a Jewish army. And the Israeli army, as I said, probably as a result of those events, expects its soldiers to take responsibility for their actions. You can never say in the Israeli army, I was following orders. You have a responsibility to analyze the orders you're given and to be sure that they are legal. And you have to be prepared to pay the price for that decision. There were individuals who, during the course of the Intifada, refused to do certain things because they felt that those orders were unethical, and they paid whatever price they paid. And that's also part of the Israeli system. So when I look at an action, I'm interested not just in the action itself, but in the implication of the action. In other words, if I do a mitzvah, do I understand where that mitzvah is coming from and where it's going to? Now, there is an interesting problem with this perspective, and then we're going to get into it. And that is that if what I said is true, then action alone can never suffice. Is that right? I mean, if I'm putting on my tefillin, or I'm eating my matzah, and I don't know what I'm doing, so it's meaningless. Except, in fact, that Jewish law says exactly the opposite. If I commit the action, even without understanding or having the proper motivation, I still fulfill the mitzvah. So that deals with a separate issue, which is how the action affects my motivation, and that's really part of tonight's lecture, so I won't give it away. But that's important. So now I've got this list, and I want to know what to do, and I want to know where to go with this list. And I want to share with you three different books on which books were written that'll give you a perception of what to do. And I want you to understand, now that we've gotten to this point, the goals of our discussion. First, if you leave this class and you're interested in seeing what the mitzvot are and figuring out how you can go about developing a relationship with those mitzvot, I want you to be able to do that at the end of this class. Not that you know all the mitzvot, but did you know where to look? Number two, I want to be able to express to you what I feel as I study the mitzvot, much less and much more as I do them, right? And number three, I want you to understand some of the thought process that went into dividing the different mitzvot. Okay, so we're going to do this one page at a time, okay? One of the most famous volumes that was ever written was not actually the first volume written as a book of mitzvot, as a list of mitzvot. It actually followed a few of the other books that were written on all of the mitzvot from 200 and even 300 years earlier. But it is clearly, for various reasons, the most famous. And that's a book written by Maimonides. Maimonides wrote a book called the Sefer HaMitzvot, the Book of Mitzvot. Maimonides was one of the greatest Jewish philosophers in the last 1,000 years. He lived in the 12th century. He was an organizer par excellence. It's quite clear that he had a photographic memory with a grasp of just about all of the oral tradition, the Torah, the Talmud, written texts, oral texts. And he succeeded in breaking down the mitzvot into 613 mitzvot. Now, I want you to understand what we're talking about here. That means that I read through the Bible, and based on the tradition that I've been given, I come up with what the 613 commandments are. We have a very, very old tradition that there are 613. But that doesn't mean that there are only 613 instances in the whole Torah where Jewish people are told to do something. So how do I know what the 613 are? And how do I know how to divide them? So that's the first issue. The second thing that's important to note before we get into this is that there is one major division that every book of mitzvot seeks to give to this whole list. And that is the difference between positive commandments and negative commandments. Between what's called a mitzvah asei, a mitzvah of do, and a mitzvah of lo ta'asei, a mitzvah of don't do. It's interesting, by the way, to note that all the books of mitzvot begin with the positive commandments. Before you start worrying about what you're not supposed to do, think about what you can do. Fill up the void. It'll be more difficult to mess up on the things you're not supposed to do. If you're so busy loving your fellow human being, then it's difficult to murder anyway. So the mitzvah of not murdering becomes that much easier. What the Rambam did was something very interesting. The first stage, of course, was a list. Read down this list for a second, okay? Believing in God. By the way, there's another issue that I'm not going to get into, which is what system Maimonides employs to come up with this order, right? For example, the first commandment that the Maimonides lists, which is the commandment to believe in God, is an interesting question in as much as the text that Maimonides uses to support this mitzvah is from the Ten Commandments, which is all the way in the book of Exodus. So why does he begin with that mitzvah? So you could argue that the Rambam is listing the mitzvot in order of priority, of importance. I can't even get started unless I accept that there's a God. Because why would I do a mitzvah if there was no God? And that may well be the Rambam's perspective, except, of course, I have another problem. Now, this is an interesting problem, right? If I was to interview two individuals to be the rabbi of my synagogue, right? We just form a board, and we're hiring a guy to be a rabbi. We're looking for a good rabbi. And the first guy comes in and says, well, looks like a good job opportunity, but I got to be honest with you. There is one problem that I have. It's a little bit of a weakness. I'm being honest with you. You should be aware of it. I love cheeseburgers. I love cheeseburgers. So you say, well, you know, it's a funny thing. Cheeseburger, Rambam. And he says, I got to go a stage further. I love cheeseburgers with pork meat. But other than that, you know, I say the Shema every day, and I study Torah, and I love my fellow human being, and all this stuff, but I love cheeseburgers. All right. Say, well, you know, other than that, I mean, your application is great, and we'll have to think about it, and whatever, we'll get back to you. And then in comes the second person, right? He says, well, you know, I've got to be honest with you. So I'm into all this stuff, and it's great, and my family loves it, and you stop my way and say, listen, do you like cheeseburgers? Cheeseburgers? No, Rabbi, I wouldn't. Cheeseburgers? Rabbi, what are you talking about? No, I just have one basic problem. I'm not sure that there's a God. I know I'm a rabbi, but I'm being honest with you. I'm an agnostic. I can't tell you 100% that I'm sure that there's a God. But because there might be a God, so I do it all. And, you know, I see a lot of beauty in it all, but I'm not 100% convinced that that beauty is because there's a God. Maybe it's just that we came up with a beautiful system. So which rabbi do you hire? If you go through your entire life and you fulfill all of the mitzvot, but 99%, you weren't sure that there was a God, maybe. Have you done something wrong? No. If, however, assuming for the moment that you buy into this biblical system, in which there is a God to begin with, then certainly, at least according to the Bible, the cheeseburger one, well, that kind of messes you up. And that was all great until I saw this Rambam. Because Maimonides here seems to say that there's a mitzvah, there's an obligation to believe in God. How do you do that? What does that mean? So that's a whole separate discussion. If you're interested in it, it's actually on tape. Finally getting a tape library together. But I would suggest that I understand why this mitzvah is first. Except that if you go down this list, and this is just the first 22. There's a list of 613 you're welcome to look at, right? So you'll see that some of them don't really fit. Like, for example, phylacteries, the tefillin. Well, up until there, all of the mitzvot apply to everybody. Now I've got a mitzvah, which at least biblically, doesn't apply to everybody. Why shouldn't I first list all the mitzvot that apply to all men and all women? Just out of curiosity, what do you think? Not that we can ever judge, but assuming for the moment, if you asked me, what do I think is more important? Wearing tefillin in the morning, or loving thy neighbor as thyself. So I would have thought loving thy neighbor as thyself is much more of an important mitzvah. But tefillin comes first. So that's difficult. And how the Rambam sets up his system is a whole discussion of pages and pages and pages in different commentaries. And it gives you a lot of an insight as to what the Rambam understands and how the Rambam views mitzvot in general. So I don't give you the response to this question, but I think it's a valuable question to be aware of as you go along. And the only way to really reach direction with this is to study all of the mitzvot. That's the catch. That's why we're not doing it now. Okay. So look down this list. So this is great. Now I've got a list of what the mitzvot are. But of course, I'm still missing something pretty basic, which is what the heck are they? So I've got a list of them, but I don't know what they are. How do they work? Now we get to the practical issue. There are many different aspects that I think ideally we would want to become aware of within the framework of studying a given mitzvah. And I want to tell you that I can give you my opinion, but I have no basis for saying that this is correct. And in fact, I know many whose opinion I greatly respect who would disagree with me. So it seems to me that there are two possibilities. Because the Rambam Maimonides takes this idea one stage further. And he says, I'm going to talk to you about what this mitzvah is. What is this mitzvah? How are you supposed to be fulfilling it? How do you fulfill love thy neighbor as thyself? How do you fulfill that? What mistakes can I make which would cause me not to fulfill it? What dilemmas might I come up against that are problematic within this mitzvah? How is this mitzvah supposed to make me a better human being? Before I get to that, and we're going to take a look at one particular mitzvah in the Rambam, I want to tell you that there are two ways to do this. One way is to go through the list of mitzvot and to say, you know what? There are maybe 50 that are my top priority. Right? In other words, for example, there's a mitzvah that if you're in the temple and you offer up a sacrifice that you sprinkle blood in the corner of the altar. Now there's a beautiful symbolism in that mitzvah, and we can learn tremendous things from it in terms of what it means to take the life even of an animal and how it's supposed to cause me pain and how I have to understand what responsibility that gives me and how it makes me feel and all sorts of other ideas. When I place the balance of sprinkling blood in the corner of the altar when I offer up a sacrifice in the temple when it should be rebuilt, God help, right? And I put that against don't steal, which is something that I have to deal with every day. So it's not difficult to imagine which one I'm going to study first. So I'm willing to bet that if you would go through a list of mitzvot, you could come up with a priority of 50 mitzvot, right? Not to steal, loving your fellow human being, giving charity, Shabbat, Kashrut, you know, some of the basic ones, the holidays. And you say, okay, these are my 50 mitzvot. Now 50 is a much more manageable number than 613. So I've got 365 days in the year. And I've got, let's say, a week to study each mitzvah. So I'm going to have a mitzvah of the week. I'll spend the first week of my mitzvah study program coming up with my list of 50. And then I'll break them down into a mitzvah a week. And this week will be that mitzvah's week. So sometimes it'll be overwhelming because one week I'll pick to study Shabbat. And some weeks it'll be a little easier because that's the week of mezuzah, of the thing that I put on the door, right, in a Jewish home. That's one way to go. The other way to go is just to study a different mitzvah every day and to get a picture of what all the mitzvot are. Because that, after all, is the tapestry of Judaism. And when you understand what all the mitzvot are, and if you're doing this as you're studying Torah, so if I'm in the middle of Leviticus, because that's the portion of the week, and I come across the opportunity of the sacrifice of an olah, a whole burnt offering, and I've actually taken a look and realized that that's a mitzvah and that mitzvah means that this is a sacrifice that I'm not obligated to bring, but I bring because I want to bring, out of thanks and what it represents, then I understand the Torah portion more, so there are all sorts of other implications. So those are your two options. You break it down, you go with your priority list, you work that way, or you say, I want to cover it. Can't be that I, as a Jew, don't at least, I'm not even aware that within my heritage there's this idea of the land lying fallow in the seventh year. So I may not have time to study all the commentaries, but at least that I should know what the mitzvot are. And then I can go back and pick the ones I want to study. Now I got to be honest with you, and then I don't have an opinion as to which is better. I think you have to find what works for you. Okay? And I don't even have an experience to share with you that I could say I did it this way or that way, because when I went through this, I was in the yeshiva world. So I was studying 15, 16 hours a day. So it wasn't a question for me, because I could do both at the same time. Right? So, you can find which one works for you. My gut feeling is that for most students, such as yourselves, the 50 list works better. Right? Even if you're going to work with all the mitzvot one after another, if you should choose to ever follow up on this, right? It still might be worth picking them in the order that they appeal to you. Okay? Now, having said that, let's take a look at Maimonides. You wanted to ask something?
Yeah. Rabbi 2 wins the job sweepstakes because he has less control over the concept of God than Rabbi One has over eating bacon cheeseburgers?
Oh, I didn't say who wins.
Okay.
I didn't say who wins. Rabbi number two, Rabbi number one is dealing with his philosophical dilemma, which is there a God?
Oh, I thought
whichever one, okay. Right? And the other rabbi is dealing with the question of, hey, I know that there's a God, and I know I'm not supposed to be doing this, in my example, but I love cheeseburgers. I just can't resist. You know when, it's Yom Kippur afternoon, and you're piling that, Big Mac into your mouth, okay, listen, if I'm living a traditional lifestyle, then I'm messing up. But what a burger. Right? So, those are two different directions.
But is it a control issue? Is it that one has less control over his basic concept of God than the other one has over his intake?
Well, they both have different issues. I don't know that it's a question of control. All I was suggesting was that the Rambam puts the mitzvah of belief first. Not because it appears in that order in the Torah. I'm going to show you very soon a book which lists the mitzvot in the order of the Torah. And those two mitzvot are useful for different things. Systems of mitzvot, okay? So now let's do something interesting, okay? What I want to do real quickly is I want to take a mitzvah which is at least easy because we can all relate to it. And imagine for the moment, okay, that I'm interested in this mitzvah. And then I want to see what this book, the Book of Mitzvot, the Rambam, Maimonides, has to say on this mitzvah. Okay? So, that's what I've done. So, let's take a look. This is a mitzvah which I think we can all relate to. The mitzvah to honor your parents. Okay? Take a moment, and read the... And by the way, this is just the raw commentary translated of Maimonides on this mitzvah. Okay? Just read the comment of Maimonides on this Mishnah, on this particular number 210 mitzvah. There's no one here who wasn't aware that there's a mitzvah to honor your parents, right? Okay. Is there anything here that you learned that you didn't think you knew before you opened up Maimonides with regards to the mitzvah? And it's not talking about how I feel when I do it or how I should do it, but that the Rambam is saying this is the mitzvah. By the way, just as an aside, I mean, that's pretty surprising. That, by the way, you should know, okay, is a halakha. That's, Maimonides quotes that halachically. How many people are on the superhuman level that they can fulfill this completely is another question. Very often, halakha is not the actual, but the ideal. We'll get to halakha, the Jewish law. But this is not like an allegorical idea that I find in a story. This is something that Maimonides puts into his system of law. You cannot offend or take offense at your parents. Now, I have to point out one very important thing. There's a difference between offending your parent and responding to your parent. If my parent comes over to my house and starts throwing my furniture out the window, first of all, I can take my parent to court, and they have to pay me for my furniture. In other words, what the halacha doesn't tell you is that after the parent has done this, you have a right to go and say, I love you so much, now please pay me back. It's mine. It's not yours. And if they don't want to pay you back, you can take them to court. But in the process of taking your parent to court, you can't offend them. It's a little funny. You can't offend them.
I'm posting this on my refrigerator.
Posting this on the refrigerator, okay.
But that sounds ridiculous.
Okay, it sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? Okay, there was one more thing that is, maybe just because that's the way I think, but this is like respecting your parent, honoring your parent, seems to be a very physical thing. I give them food, I give them drink, I give them sustenance. What about emotional? Interesting. Can I obligate emotion is an interesting question. Okay. Pardon? Oh. In other words, you can't, my mother's English, and she was very clever, because when we were kids, she would never tell us that we had to respect her. She would tell us how to behave to our father. So we understood. And I remember, I must have been about 10. And 10 or 11. And it was the NHL Stanley Cup Finals. Okay? This is the biggest game in hockey. And it was like the third period. And it was this incredible moment. I think it was even the Islanders that had finally, New York Islanders had finally gotten into the Stanley Cup. This was it. It doesn't get much bigger than this. You know, God came down that afternoon to give the Ten Commandments, and most of us were too busy. Because the Stanley Cup. And my father came home at the end of a business day. And we were sitting, I actually had a couple friends over, right, which made this action even more severe. Because my mother was very, very careful if she was going to tell us off not to do it in front of our friends, right? And my father came home, and we were watching the Stanley Cup. It was like, you know, normal afternoon, you know. Dad comes in. Hi, guys. Now, my mother would never come into the door and say, take my coat. Because you're giving two messages that don't work to a 10-year-old kid. But in the next 60 seconds, the world changed. First of all, the TV went off. Second of all, whereas one second I was looking at, I don't even remember who it was anymore, I think it was Wayne Gretzky, who was flying down the ice. The next minute I was looking at two hands like this, right, that were on my mother's hips in front of the television, right? She didn't have to say anything, right? She just, and I've employed this tactic on my children. It's a very good tactic. And she just looked at me with this look of incredible shock, horror, and amazement. And I'm thinking, like, what happened? Who died? Right? Because this thing went right over my head, right? And she's looking at me, and I'm looking at her, and, you know, the storm is boiling. Like, my mother had this look like the raging storm, right? And I'm trying to process this, not because I'm saying to myself, ooh, here's this golden opportunity for an ethical and moral experience. No, I'm thinking, like, how do I solve this so I can watch the hockey game, right? And I can't come up with a solution. And after 30 seconds, when my mother realizes that I don't have a solution to this problem, right, it gets worse. Because not only did I mess up, but I don't even know why I messed up. How could you not know that your father came home and you didn't jump up to get his coat, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it was a powerful image that I still have. Because if your father walks in the door, if your mother walks in the door, you fly out of your chair. I mean, I don't know if you were at my Wednesday night lecture last week. So my parents came, and they don't usually get to come, whatever. I love it when they come. It's fun. It's kind of an opportunity to pay them back for all they did for me. But in many ways. Yeah. It's an interesting Freudian slip. But it wouldn't occur to me to give a lecture where my parents are present without saying Birshut Avimori or Birshut Imimorati with the permission of my parents or my teachers. Because you can't be giving a lecture in front of your parents and not sort of acknowledge the fact that your parents are sitting there. I mean, it's like you ever see these big the big dinners, and the person gets up, or the bar mitzvah boy, you know, right? And they have to sort of pay homage first to the list. There's that golden list, right? Mr. President, Mr. Chairman, honored and distinguished colleagues, rabbis, rabbis' mothers, you know, all these different people on the list. So your parents are chief on the list. And this seems, you're right, to be a very physical thing. But what's amazing about this is what this halacha tells me is not just fly out of your chair and go to the door and get your dad's coat, aware all the time that he's perfectly healthy and doesn't need you to take his coat, that it's an action, right, which makes no sense. You have to do it with joy. You have to love doing it. And if you don't love doing it, then you didn't do it right. So go back to the drawing board. So if I jumped up with my eyes on the hockey game and ran to the door and said, oh, Dad, welcome home. Here's your coat. Yeah, have a nice day. Run back. Then my mother would have come back and said, did you love it? Now, what is that? It doesn't make sense. And why is the Rambam telling me this? So this clues us into what the Rambam is trying to do. And then, since I see that this mitzvah interests you, so we'll take maybe 2 minutes just to discuss it, but I want you to know the most important thing is that we tend to look at mitzvah, we tend to look at actions, right, as just the technical machination, the blueprint of how to do it. What the Rambam, Maimonides, inevitably does is to say to me, how are you supposed to do this, not just on the outside, but on the inside? And there are many questions that arise. Now, I will give you a couple of perspectives, which will perhaps give you some food for thought with regards to a couple of the questions that you asked. First of all, interesting question. I used to get students. I ran a program, a yeshiva program, had a yeshiva, for boys who were just graduated from high school in America. I had a couple of English boys. So they were 18, 19 years old. And they came here for the year, and they were still being supported largely by their parents. And inevitably, in the course of the year, some of them would sort of discover the tremendous potential that such an experience could give them, and they would begin to acquire. They would go from that sort of we're away from home mentality to look at what we can accomplish. And very often, and that's the nature of things, we only start to really appreciate these things when we're halfway through them. So they missed the first half of the year in terms of what they could have done. And sometimes you would find boys sort of at the end of the year, Passover time, Pesach time, and they'd be sitting there from 7 in the morning until 2 in the morning, and they'd be learning all day and loving it. And then the question would be, okay, well, should I stay a second year? Should I stay a second year? It's called Shana Bet, year 2, and it's a whole concept in the yeshiva world. And it's clear that from the perspective of gaining from this yeshiva experience, having a second year, you know, you can't compare someone who comes to study Torah right out of high school for a year, just because everybody does it, and because he has the opportunity to get away from home, be on his own, live on his own, you know, have fun, to a boy who decides to stay a second year, put off college, etc., right? Add to that the fact that it's not just a question of coming for a year and then taking that opportunity again, but the second year is not just another opportunity to have a first year. It's a year which comes on the heels of having the first year experience, which makes it a much more valuable experience very often than waiting 2 or 3 years and coming back for a year a different time. Because you're coming off that thought, mental process. And inevitably, some of the boys would be interested in doing this, and they'd come to talk to you, and you'd say, well, you know, it depends on you, and it depends what you're looking for, and is it the right thing for you to do, and for sure you shouldn't do it unless you really want to do it, and even if you do want to do it, do you know what you're giving up to do it, and is it the right thing, etc. And very often, you know, you can imagine parents had some legitimate, serious hesitations. You know, it's one thing for my boy to put off college for a year, put off college for 2 years. All his friends are already going to be juniors when he comes back. He's going to be out of that, you know, high school mentality, college mentality of university courses. Is he going to get back into it? And all sorts of other questions. So I once had a student who came to me and said, look, I know this is what I want to do. I know. And I know how much I'll gain from this year. And I say to myself, when I'm 60 years old, am I really going to remember whether I had 42 years on the workforce or 41 years on the workforce? Right? And so for me, this year now is going to be more valuable than an additional year doing whatever, so I want to do this. So I said, okay, sounds to me like you know you want to do it. What do you need me for? He says, well, my parents, they also know what they want to do. They want to send a squad over here to grab me, bundle me into a duffel bag, zip me, put me in a luggage compartment, and send me home. And they tell me that I can't do this. And not only do they tell me that I can't do this, but they tell me that they're not willing to foot the bill for it. And they say that they're going to disown me, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What should I do? I say, good question. And then he adds that final kicker. Aren't I obligated to listen to my parents? Respect your parents. Kabeid et avicha v'timecha. Do I have... I'm staying in Israel, the whole reason, because I want to study the tradition and get more in tune with my Jewish identity and learn the halakha. In order to do that, I'm going to break one. Can I do this? So I said to him, okay. There's two separate issues. First of all, and this became a conversation that I repeated with many another student. What do you think? Do you have an obligation to listen to your parent? They're your parents. They know more than you do. They brought you into this world. Do you think you have an obligation to listen to your parents in that instance? Obviously, you know, you'd be a fool not to pay attention to what they have to say and listen to their experience. But ultimately, if you can't reach a compromise, you want to stay, they say go back. Listen to it. If I tell my daughter it's time to go to bed, she says, well, do I have to listen to my father? You're darn right. Darn right. Halachically, she doesn't have the option to stay up. Now, she doesn't know that yet. But halachically speaking, she has to go to bed because I said so. So, do you think you have to listen to your parents or not? And if so or not, why? Let's say my 7-year-old daughter says, I don't want to go to bed, I want to study Mishnah. It happened. She has this thing, she has to do, what's it called, Shinun. She has to go over the particular portion that she studied that day, she has to review it. So she's very clever. So she leaves that till the end. So that when I come, and it took me about a week to figure out what she was doing, right? So when I come to say it's time to go to bed, she would say, oh, I have to do my Shinun, which means going through the verses from the Torah that she studied that day. How can you tell your daughter to go to bed don't study Torah, right? So I got smart, and I started asking her, did she do Shinun an hour and a half before bedtime? But if I say to her to go to bed, don't do your Shinun, she still has to listen to me. In fact, there's a magnificent pasuk, a magnificent verse, and it's based on this verse that the Talmud, in the tractate of Kedushin, gives us the answer to this question, from a halachic perspective. When Adam is created, okay, and finally finds, through various procedures and journeys, his soulmate, Chava, Eve, and they get together. The verse comes along, gives me a very strange verse. Al ken yazov ish et aviv et imo. Therefore must a man leave his father and mother, vidavak beishto, and cling to his wife, vihayu levasar echad, and they become one. Now there are a lot of interesting things about that verse. It's the man who has to do the leaving. He has to go to the woman, not the woman having to go to the man, which is very important. It is the woman who, well, whatever, we won't get into detail, right? It's a little strange because there is no father and mother. This is Adam and Eve. But the Talmud learns from this verse that when I get to the stage of decisions that affect my life, I don't have to listen to my parents. Take an extreme example. I fall in love with a girl. She's the one for me, and my parents say, we don't allow you to marry her. I don't have a halachic responsibility to listen to my parents. I'd be an idiot not to take into account what they have to say. They know me. They have experience. I should want to hear what they have to say, but like you say, I don't have to listen to it. That's number one. And that goes for all life decisions, medical school or law school. If I want to be a traveling artist, and they tell me, listen, you have the opportunity to be a brain surgeon, right? So I should listen to what they have to say, but I don't have to listen to them. Now, that takes you to the next stage of respect for your parents, which is that the idea behind respect for your parents, and it's very interesting, you can look at a mitzvah from two perspectives. You can try to figure out what the idea is, and then go from the idea, okay, to the particular legal aspects of it, or you can look at the legal aspects of it and try to glean from them the idea. You understand the difference? The Rambam chooses a second. Here is the halakha. Here's how it works. Now you figure out what it means. The Rambam does go far enough as to say that the basis of this mitzvah, when you think about it, is equated with listening to God. Why is that? Because my parents are in a partnership with God. And it's the three of them that brought me into this world. The appreciation of God in general. Heeding Hashem, if you find Hashem, and if you develop a relationship with Hashem, is based on the idea that I've been given something. And when I listen to God, it's because I have gratitude to God. That's the essential feeling that I'm supposed to have towards my parents. Gratitude. I want you to know now, as I've become a parent, and I'm starting to appreciate what goes into being a parent, I'm gaining a whole new appreciation for my parents. Because like it hits you all of a sudden, when I was like 3 months old, like they had to get up in the middle of the night, and they had to take off that thing and, you know, take care of it. They did that for me. There was no one else in the world who would do that for me. I mean, I like you all, and we have a nice relationship, but I don't think you'd do that for me. I don't think I'd do that for you. And our parents did that for us. And all the way on down the line, parents make mistakes. Here's the second issue. When you look at your parents and you realize your parents have made mistakes, it's one of those instances where you don't know that you won't make the same mistakes because you're not where they're at yet. Fascinating idea. It doesn't mean you have to accept their mistakes. If my relationship with my parents is a function not just of my relationship with my parents, but my relationship with Hashem, with the partner of those parents, then I begin to understand why it is, first of all, that it's included in the Ten Commandments. And second of all, why I seem to have this obligation, no matter who they are. Now, there are certain instances, halakhically, where I'm allowed, and one of them was just mentioned in the verse, to distance myself from my parents. In fact, if your soul, if your life is at stake, and certainly if a parent is abusing a child, it would be fair to say, there are even responsible to discuss this, that that's a life-threatening situation in certain ways. So you can distance yourself from your parents. You can take legal recourse against your parents, such as in the case of the jewels over the boat. But that doesn't mean that you can ever reach a stage, right, where you go beyond that in how you react to your parents. So sometimes that may require a superhuman effort. And sometimes simply the effort, whether successful or not, is valuable. And when you stop to think about the real underlying idea of a mitzvah that we mentioned at the beginning of the week, which is what the mitzvah does for me, then it goes without saying that this is just the beginning of a thought process. What does it do for me as a human being when I do something for my parents? How do I become better? How does the world become a better place? Because I'm treating my parents a certain way. I don't know if you've ever seen or had the misfortune to see a parent, a child, mistreat their parents. I've unfortunately been in that situation. It's a horrible thing to see. Horrible. To see a student who treats his parents a certain way and doesn't even realize what he's doing. And then it makes you think, did I ever do that to my parents? Could a person be that insensitive? And all that is the idea of analyzing one mitzvah. And it's just like we were talking about in studying Torah. First of all, what is the mitzvah? What's the story? Second, I go back. What bothers me about that story, or in this case, about that mitzvah? Right? It's the same thought process. And third, okay, what do I do with that? What do I do with that? What does it mean to me? We're taking the same system of learning, and we're applying it to mitzvot. And by the way, do an experiment if you ever decide to pursue this. Study one mitzvah on your own, and then go back, find someone else, a chavruta, and study the same mitzvah with a chavruta. Watch the difference. It's unbelievable. Now, I just want to tell you two last things, simply as a practical issue. So this is Maimonides. There are two other books. One of them I don't have here. I thought I did, and I do apologize, but I will bring it in. The second is a book called The Mitzvot. Now, The Mitzvot, I'm going to give you something to read in the break if you want to. If not, that's fine. The Mitzvot is written by a guy named Abraham Chill. It's in my office.
Abraham
Chill. You know what? I'm going to put these, both of these, over here. Right? A lot of these books, by the way, are my personal books, so don't disappear with them if you don't mind. But if you, you know, just so that they should be here, so if you want to take a chance and go over and look at them or whatever, right? I'll put this over here. This is a magnificent, magnificent set. This is a wonderful, wonderful book. First of all, it goes in the order of the Torah, which means that if I'm studying the weekly Torah portion, I can figure out which mitzvot are in that weekly portion, and I can take a look at them. Okay, that's A. Second of all, in addition to defining the mitzvah and giving me a few of the halach, it does two things. It gives me a few of the interesting halachot, or laws about the mitzvah, and you can read this on your own, right? And then it gives me some of the basic commentaries on that mitzvah. What does Nachmanides say? What does Maimonides say? What does the Kli Yakar say? And by the way, and this is valuable, irrespective of mitzvot, at the beginning of this book, this particular author has a list of all the commentaries that he quotes throughout the book, and he gives you a brief biography on who they are, where they lived, when they lived, and how they thought. Right? So that's also valuable. So this is a magnificent book. You can get this in just about any Jewish bookstore. Okay? And again, it's called The Mitzvot by Abraham Chill. This book, by the way, if you choose to go the 613 route, all right, this is a magnificent way to do it because you can really cover a mitzvah a day, as you'll see when you take a look at it. Okay? The third book which I wanted to mention to you on this topic is a very interesting experiment by a guy named the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim, Rav Yisrael Meir Kagan, who lived at the turn of the century, he died in 1927, just before, or 27 or 32, I'll have to remember this, it was just before the Holocaust. He was without a doubt, by all accounts, the greatest Torah sage of the last generation, of 60, 70 years ago. He was renowned for his tremendous love for his fellow human being. His major undertaking in his lifetime was an attempt to influence the entire Jewish people in terms of slander, that they should stop speaking Lashon Hara. That was how he gained fame. He was much less concerned, although he wrote one of the, if not the, works on Jewish halakha, certain parts of it called the Mishnah Brura. His major concern was how we learn to relate to our fellow human beings. I have a feeling that if he was alive today, he would have a lot to say on what's going on. And he wrote a little book, actually as a result of a request of a few of his students, who were drafted into the Russian army. And in those days, if a Jew went to the Russian army, it was almost over for his Judaism. They would draft you for 20 years. They didn't have a kosher food program. They didn't have a get up early and pray program. Very difficult to maintain any sort of religious focus in the Russian army. And so he wrote a book, which was called the Sefer Mitzvot HaKatzar, or the Kitzur HaMitzvot, I forget, the concise book of mitzvot, it's called in English. He lists only the mitzvot that apply to us in our day. He's not interested in the laws of sacrifice. And it was a guide to boys who were in the Russian army. And he gives a very short paragraph on each mitzvah, who it applies to, when it applies, what the basic rules are, so that you can read one paragraph and have a basic working knowledge of how a mitzvah works. And it's published by Feldheim, called The Concise Book of Mitzvot, in a magnificent volume, which is about this big and this thin. You can fit it in your pocket. It's a great thing to carry on the bus. I know that they have it, or if they don't, you can order it here in the Mariah's Foreign Store, because I've seen it. I have one at home. I'll try to remember to bring it in. And it's a great thing to have, like, you know, if you're going on the bus or whatever and you want something reading, you can read one little page about this size and you can cover a mitzvah. It's the kind of thing you could realistically do in 10 minutes a day and get through at least the basic mitzvot if you should ever choose that this is the learning project that you decide to undertake. Pardon? The Concise Book of Mitzvot. Okay? By the Chafetz Chaim. Okay? C-H-A-F-E-T-Z. Chafetz. C-H-A-I-M. Chaim. Okay? I hope, there's never enough time for these things, that this gives you at least an inkling, an idea of this topic within Judaism, and specifically within Jewish books, and that if you should ever decide to pursue this, you'll at least have sort of some direction of where to go to pursue this project if this is what you ever choose to do. By the way, one last thought. If you ever find yourself in a situation where you'd like to teach someone else about Judaism, be it a child or a nephew or a friend or whoever, right? This is a wonderful way to start. Wonderful thing to be able to do for somebody else. To go through a different mitzvah every time and share it with someone else is a very easy thing to do. So just from that perspective, it's a valuable project to be aware of for that time in your life where you might find the project you want to undertake.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.